After Dark, welcome back. People who are supporting us, we love you. We absolutely love you.
We had a very good month, Brad. So to all the newcomers, everybody, welcome aboard. Yes. You're on the Good Ship Patreon. These numbers are sustainable. If we see this kind of support consistently month over month, year over year, we got a really good thing going. Obviously, we want to keep growing it. We want to keep all y'all who are already on board, stick with us. You are early adopters. Mm-hmm. If you're listening to this, you're one of the first 200 people to support this podcast. Now, imagine 5 years from now, 10 years from now, the catalog is huge. I go on Terry Gross, Brad can't because of the situation, the incident, but I go on Terry Gross. You'll be able to say, I knew Kevin before the incident.
Yeah.
So this is a good thing, but we really truly appreciate it. It means a lot to us. And Casey's back for the After Dark, and we're talking more Emily D. Of all the figures that we've covered, I have to say that, you know, there's a quote David Mamet has, something he wrote about Bach, who we'll cover at some point. And he said, Bach has to be like the greatest artist because he committed so few spiritual crimes.
Mm.
And wonderful quote from the great David Mamet, who's certainly committed some spiritual. He knows a thing or
two about
times. And the theater is very dirty and kind of ugly relative to the purity of music. I'll say that as a theater guy. It just is. It's kind of it's messy. There is something vaguely criminal about theater. I got off the rails here, but Emily seems pure. And I'm not just saying that because they put her on her stuff on tote bags. And do you know, like, separate yourself from that brand and just look at the work itself. Mm-hmm. She seems, I don't exactly know what I'm saying, but of all the figures, well, no, I do. Of all the figures we've covered, she's one of the ones who I think gets out relatively unscathed. We've covered monsters, bad people, and I don't get the impression that Emily D was, if she was, it was maybe in her own head. Anyway, go on, Brent.
I think there is something there is something about not, and as we said in the core episode, it's not that she never tried to get published or anything like that, and there were sort of, there were conditions as a woman that made it challenging, though far from impossible, to have a career as a writer. There is something about at least the perception that she wasn't trying to be in, like, publishing. It wasn't about getting your that latest thing in the right magazine and making a connection with this person. There's no striver. She has nothing about of the striver in her. And that's always like, that's refreshing as somebody who's trying to make art. It's refreshing to see these cases of these people. It's a little disheartening that she didn't get to sort of see some level of success or recognition, but there's also this sense of like, oh yeah, remember, like, the reason you started doing this is because how it felt to write a little story. That's why, and years have passed since then, but ultimately, whenever you get in the labyrinth of this thing, you always just have to remember it's about just doing it, the act of doing it. And so she's sort of like my patron saint of that. And also, she was a witch.
Right.
so let's talk about this a little
bit. When does spooky season start? Is it it's like the last week of September, I think. And I think we're here. So
yeah, sort of
get into it. Witches.
I think once fall has started, you're sort of there. Mm-hmm. We're actually gonna revisit the poem that Casey read, but first I kind of want to set this up a little bit. Various scholars have assigned different sort of archetypal characters that Emily Dickinson was sort of was playing with: the little girl, the queen, the wife, She refers to herself as a boy a couple of times. There is a notion, I might have it here someplace. There is a notion, a way of looking at some of the writing as though she's playing out a nun character, right? These sort of archetypes that are on the stage for different perspectives to sort of refract this stuff through. And there's an interesting thesis by this woman named Amy Sparks from 1990 called The White Witch, Emily Dickinson and Colonial American Witchcraft. She makes the case that of these sort of character, these archetypal characters that Emily was leveraging and inhabiting at various times, the one that has always been sort of missing is identifying with witchcraft. And you really actually don't have to go that far to see Emily making a nod at it. And let me quickly-ish reread I Think I Was Enchanted. Casey did such a good job with it. But for people who are listening to this and don't remember it from the main episode, I want to just give it a quick read again. I think I was enchanted when first a somber girl, I read that foreign lady, the dark, felt beautiful. And whether it was at noon or only heaven at, or sorry, or whether it was noon at night or only heaven at noon, for very lunacy of light, I had not power to tell. The bees became as butterflies, the butterflies as swans, approached and spurned the narrow grass and just the meanest tunes that nature murmured to herself to keep herself in cheer. I took for giants practicing titanic opera. The days to mighty meters stepped, the homeliest adorned, as if unto a jubilee, 'twere suddenly confirmed. I could not have defined the change, conversion of the mind, like sanctifying in the soul, is witnessed, not explained. 'Twas a divine insanity, the danger to be sane. Should I again experience 'tis antidote to turn to tomes of solid witchcraft, magicians be asleep, but magic hath an element like deity to keep. Okay. So good. Now, one of the things that would make you a witch in colonial New England, and again, this is, it's important to understand. In Emily Dickinson's time,
piercings, leather pants,
Topic
credit card. Right. You've got too many QR B sides. Bauhaus VIP tickets.
That's what makes
you a witch
in 2023. But this is, you know, Emily didn't have access to all of this.
Oh,
you know, she might have gotten into that.
The Amherst Hot Topic didn't open until 1805.
That's right. There's a couple of things we need to think about, not only in this poem, but otherwise. To become the phenomenon of the witch. So if you were being accused of being a witch, say during the Salem witch trials, which again, this is 100, what, Salem witch trials, I think were 1692.
Let me just say, historically, one of the very worst times to be accused of being a witch. Top five bad times.
If you get accused of being a witch now, literally nobody notices or cares.
Well, I'm gonna contest some this, countries. Though.
But go ahead.
Okay.
Good. So there are a couple of things at which sort of are identified with witchcraft. One of them would be being initiated, particularly by another woman, into the art of witchcraft. And so in this poem, we see Emily being initiated by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She basically says this. I mean, you know, conversion of the mind. It does tap into the religious conversions that were going on. But of course, Emily is always talking about multiple things at the same time. I mean, it might have even seemed ironic to her that you're supposed to have this conversion experience in Congregationalism, but also witches had conversion experiences, right? That wouldn't have not, she would have noticed that, I think. Another aspect is women who were accused of witchcraft were typically religious rebels of some kind. This would be when it wasn't, there were a lot of cases of women being accused of witchcraft and convicted of witchcraft where it was literally like, a woman who didn't have any male heirs and she stood to inherit a large estate. And so people started thinking, well, how do we get her money? well, turns out, you know what? She's a witch. I saw her doing, you know, and they just make up some cock. And especially if she was a little bit eccentric, right? Or she maybe didn't always go to church. Then you had her dead to rights, right?
Right. And ironically, if you have that kind of fuck you money coming down the line, you might not go to church. You might be a little eccentric. So you see how it's a virtuous circle of witch hunting. Nothing like this happens today in any public sphere ever. Yes. Nobody ever has any motivation to point the finger and to send a mob after anybody ever anymore. And certainly we don't have technology that would exacerbate this.
No.
So thank goodness we're talking about history. Brad's giving us history.
Right. Yeah. And let's say that you were, well, I'm not going to get into it. There's a recent case.
No, that's forget about it. I don't know.
That's fine. Know. That's object.
Touch grass. Touch grass, Brad.
Okay, so now here's another thing. Witches are participating in magic of some kind. Now, the thing, and we're going to maybe touch on this a little bit because I found a very interesting book about the history of witchcraft in New England. And it turns out that especially in the 17th century and even into the 18th century, a lot of people were practicing domestic magic of various kinds.
I love that. They kick out the cat. We got to purify.
It was the Catholics doing it, Kevin.
Oh, good. Oh, perfect. Good. Nothing changes. That's what I'm saying. Okay.
It was the Catholics doing the magic for the most part.
Oh, good.
The Puritans did not care for the magic whatsoever.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Now, you could have a Puritan community in which some weirdos were in there who were practicing magic, but doctrinally.
But officially, as soon as you were identified as a weirdo in the Puritan community, you were a Catholic. That's true.
but so on this note, this practicing of magic, Emily Dickinson consciously thought of her words as she probably even may have used the term magic to describe this. Let me just read this little bit from this thesis by Amy Sparks. As poet, Dickinson tapped into the elemental power of language, and like the witches of 17th century New England, she uses words to cast spells to charm her future audience. It is in her words, her poetry, where we see this most striking evidence of her witchcraft. For instance, in the poem, Witchcraft Was Hung in History. Let me just read that really quick. Witchcraft was hung in history, but history and I find all the witchcraft that we need us around us every day. I added an extra us in there. Sorry about that. So there's just this, and there's another thing that where this ties into Emily's biography, this use of words as magic, right? And people, this is a fairly, if you haven't thought of this before, I mean, magic and language, it's pretty clear the connection between them. Abracadabra is ABC, right? You cast a spell. This isn't revelatory in any way, but to think, it's one thing to know that historically, it's another thing for an artist like Emily Dickinson to be sort of deliberate about that. And one thing we see in her biography is that when somebody died, a cousin, a friend of a friend, she was often called upon to write a letter to them. Because
a letter to the dead?
Not to the dead, but to the family, to the bereaved.
Okay.
Because she had a unique capacity for writing the kinds of things that would actually help you. You know how when you write in a card to somebody and you're like, I don't know what to say. Like, I don't know what to say to these people. You know,
moments like that are, that's a great point. Cause moments like that are where like the soul of a writer comes through or it doesn't, because those moments are opportunities for every fucking cliche. Just that's what comes to your mind because you're processing your own reaction. It's like when a friend goes through a breakup, what do you immediately pops your head? You know, you're thinking somewhere subconsciously, you're thinking about every single breakup you've ever gone through. So the first thing that comes to your head is, well, time passes. You're gonna be fine. You just need time. And now you sound like a moron.
Right.
Right. So there's an art, and then death is that to the end. Because what are you going to say?
Right,
what are you going to say? Thoughts and prayers.
Everybody's talked and thought about this for millennia. What are you going to come up with something new to address? Right, and apparently Emily Dickinson was very good at writing a letter that you would receive, and maybe even just for a second, it would soothe your soul, right? And if that's not magic, then I mean, is there any magic, right? And to know that she was doing that deliberately, knowing my words can help heal this person. And I'm not going to go into too many more details about that, but I think interesting.
She has a poem about if I could heal one broken heart. Are you familiar with that poem? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see if I can.
Yeah.
Or while you're looking it up, the really short one that goes, go a word is dead when it is said, some say. Yeah. I say it just begins to live that day.
Yeah. I love
that. That's the magic of words, is that they kind of have life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Kevin. Yeah.
Oh, no. That's great. Yeah. I love it. And I've got two more tiny little poems here. One is, if I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain. If I can ease one life the aching, or cool one pain, or help one fainting robin unto his nest again, I shall not live in vain. Love and beautiful.
It's beautiful.
It's like St. Francis level stuff.
Right? It is. It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's the white witch. Yeah.
Here's another one. Unto a broken heart. Unto a broken heart, no other one may go without the high prerogative itself hath suffered too. Yeah. Unto a broken, no other one may go without the highest prerogative. I think that's summarizing what I was trying to say earlier. Unto a broken heart, no other one may go without the high prerogative itself hath suffered too. Anyway.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, here's another way in which Emily fits into the tradition of witchcraft, the history of, and this isn't just a sort of, oh, that's a neat correspondence. There is a reasonable chance, as we discussed in our, specifically, I think, in the Patreon, the After Dark portion of our Emily Dickinson Core episode, about the fact that she may have had epilepsy. And if she didn't have epilepsy, she had some other kind of condition, sort of chronic, incurable thing that may have encouraged her to stay home, let's say. There is a long tradition of epilepsy being associated with witchcraft in the colonies. Basically, it kind of went the other way, though. It went, if a child had epilepsy, it was suspected that witchcraft was implicated in it, that a witch had cast a spell on this child, and that's why the child had epilepsy. There are symptoms of epilepsy that appear like, you know, demonic possession, right? If you don't know what a seizure is, that looks pretty similar to what I would imagine a demonic possession could look like, right? So the fact that she also has this medical condition that is confining, limiting, alienating, kind of pushes her out to the fringe of society. Imagine what would have happened to Emily Dickinson if she had not had a prominent, wealthy father, right? It would have been a very different life. She was sort of allowed to sit in her room, right, and do the things that she did. We can go into, let's talk, because it's spooky season and I'm interested in this topic. Let's talk a little bit about Cotton Mather. I mentioned him, Casey, and you were like, you were on it. So what do you know about, what can you tell us about Casey Cotton Mather? And if you don't know something, we'll try to fill it in.
Yeah, a couple. Okay. So I have like three anecdotes I want to tell about Cotton Mather vaguely. So the first, and it's like to give you the sense of the history of it, because basically the first American witch would probably have been Anne Hutchinson in 1636, but they weren't quite using witchcraft in the same way yet. But Hutchinson's whole thing, obviously these are all Protestants. It's so bizarre that they didn't see this coming, you know, this problem. But like they get to the New World, they set up their little towns, you know, with the church in the center of it, and you've got the deacons and the minister and so on. And then you also have this very hyper literate, like that's all they do, right? Like they don't have sports or Twitter or anything. They just sit around and read the Bible mostly. Right. And they're teaching everyone to read it. So somebody like Anne Hutchinson, who, I mean, from what we can tell, was maybe the daughter of some minister, but it's not even clear. But anyway, she clearly read her Bible. And so when she, her rebellion against, you know, the quote unquote orthodoxy of the local Puritan church comes not from without. Like, it's actually not the hot topic girl with like punk spiked hair and, you know, piercings and stuff. It's actually from within the church. You know what I mean? The call is coming from within the church. And she's saying, like, this is, I basically just disagree with the minister's interpretation of the texts. So it's like, well, what do you do at that point? You know, you can't really, because, like, there's no pope anymore.
That's supposed to be allowed. That's supposed to be allowed.
Yeah, as long as it's in like good conscience.
Yeah.
And there's this great moment. I don't know if any of you have ever, there's a documentary that featured the guy who played Ben Linus on Lost as John Winthrop. And it was made by PBS. It's called God in America. So in episode one, they go over this. And I it's such a good like episode in history. And what happens is they had like a trial. They bring Anne Hutchinson in, you know, they go like, do you claim to like essentially hear revelations from God? And she's like, yes, I do. Mm. And they're kind of like, how, you know, that's, you're not Abraham. And she's like, well, in the same way that Abraham did. And it's like, at that point, there's really nothing left to be said, because it's like, that's the final frontier of revelation. Like, if, you know, I mean, if Abraham himself had been brought up on trial, like, no one else heard God talk to him, you know, he heard it. So
you
then
can't
like
prove
when
it. You can't just
Inquisitor
prove it.
Comes, it's kind of like, I'm telling you, man.
Right.
You know?
And right.
That's kind of what happened with Anne Hutchinson. By the way, they kicked her out.
Yeah.
They made
she
her
was
leave.
She was exiled from,
exiled. And they did the same to like Roger Williams, I think a few years later.
Yeah. And
in, like,
I think with Anne Hutchinson, one thing she was doing was she was midwifing. She did midwife work, or and at some point one of the children she was the midwife for came out malformed in some way.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. So like that's the kind of thing where like now all of a sudden there must be demons here, maybe, or something like that.
Right.
But yeah,
that
like,
was one thing a witch would do. That's what a witch
absolutely
would do.
And I think if she had lived, you know, 50 years later, she definitely would have been hanged for it. Mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. So okay, but I did want to mention that, so you had like that first generation, you had John Cotton and John Winthrop and whoever else, I can't remember all their names, but that's in like the 1620s and 1630s after the Mayflower, right? And then that generation that included Increase Mather in the middle of the 17th century, where finally now they've got like probably, you know, the houses are built. You've got the second generation, kind of a first generation of kids born in the New World. Mm-hmm. And they had this problem with conversions, basically. Like they had the idea that you had to have had this conversion experience or else you can't really be a Christian. Well, a lot of the kids weren't having the experience. So it became this crisis because like the church is going to collapse. Like it's only like 1 out of 10 of the children are having conversion experiences. They had to kind of concoct this compromise situation called the halfway covenant, which is like this idea that you can come to the church and like you can, like maybe, I can't remember what else, participate, but then like when they serve the communion, you have to leave. And by the way, this would have been in a situation that like Emily was in, like she could attend the church, but not take the communion with everybody else there. So really an interesting period. But
so this period, let me understand this. So in this period, the minister was performing mass, not, not a mass proper.
No, they would have called it like a meeting house, not a church, and it was very, you know.
But and we're past transubstantiation here, so they're
right.
I'm
not actually sure. I don't know my Calvinism enough about that.
Okay.
But it's
a big deal if you're not, you know, if they're doing a ritual around the supper and you're not coming
and you're not
in
invited. Yeah,
you're not invited at the end. Yeah, that's
By the way, then in like the third generation is when you get a guy like Cotton Mather, who, first of all, let's give him props, was like a genius. This guy's like a real autodidact. He apparently had, you know, written 300 books and probably owned 2000 books. And like a lot of times, like I have a sense that people who grow up in our age kind of think of themselves as knowing more than like the Puritans, for example. And maybe in some ways, because you have your phone and you can watch, you know, National Geographic or whatever. But these people read all the classics in Latin or Greek or whatever. And they, you know, they were huge brain people in some
way. And they had stuff memorized.
Yeah, memorized. It was a different kind of a culture. It was all based around reading and telling the stories and so on. But anyway, around 1685, Maybe one of you guys can Google this for me while I'm telling the story. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Cotton Mather wrote a book. I think it's called Magnalia Christi Americana or something like that. And if I remember reading
Magnalia
this,
Christi Americana. Yep.
Okay. I'm pretty sure that's the book where he felt a, you know, there was this kind of third generation thing. This happens in Hesiod too. It's like you imagine the grandparents as the golden generation. And then, you know, because like they came to the new world, they established this city. It's such an epic tale. And then like, you're just Cotton Mather. You're not even in Priest Mather, let alone John Cotton.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a sense that like the true, you know, chosenness by God or whatever was kind of waning. By then, some of the Enlightenment books had crept in. So like Cotton Mather would have owned books by I can't think of early Enlightenment thinkers, but they're starting to do science and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So Mather's intention like here was
Erasmus and
collect. This is really interesting. He collects a bunch of stories, both from the New World and the Old World, of like supernatural experiences. So like visions, dreams, contact with ghosts potentially or whatever.
Okay.
And he puts these, you know, in a book.
Ooh,
and they're just like reports of mystical, magical, supernatural stuff. And of course, the intention is to like spur belief, like faith. And I think that makes sense. Like to me, you know, like if I see one ghost, that's it. Like I know there's another realm forever.
Right.
You know?
Right. So yeah. You got to deal with that. And it,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think part of what happened then is that like in 1691, 92, it almost worked too well. Like people in the village, like were like, it's all real again.
Right.
You know? And they like, you can kind of see their, like they light up in that way. And so part of what's happening here, I think, is that people are kind of doing the thing where they're perceiving daily regular interactions, but there's like, they become kind of burdened with metaphysical meaning and
insane. They start to become insane.
It's insane. It's a kind of paranoia, yeah. I guess. Mm-hmm. But I also want to, I kind of want to defend them too, Kevin, because I think like, you know what I mean? Like I want to come down right in the middle of this, because in some way that is what the life of like true faith might look like, where there are really demons and really angels. And
well, there
like,
I agree. I'm with you. That sounds insane, but yeah, no, I'm
so
with
like,
you.
Yeah. If you go to a psychiatrist, they tell you you're insane, but like a saint might like do whatever they have, or a witch, you know, these are the warriors on the battlefield.
Right. Right.
And so they might try to help in different terms rather than just, you know,
I think a lot of the hysteria may have emerged out of the fact that they, if that was coming up, like we're starting to talk about ghosts and all as a means to sort of re-energize the faithful, coming out of a culture where there's definitely no theater. Probably not a lot of dancing, but say there's not a Kevin Bacon coming out of the woodwork.
Oh,
here.
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
So you have all of that. So that's a long way to go from that culture to ghosts are real.
Right.
And the human impulse to dramatize everything is never going to go away.
Right.
And then what kind of drama is a witch trial?
Oh, yeah.
It's a play. Right.
Yeah, it's a play. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, I've also thought about it. I mean, there is the idea that, like, you know, I think if I remember correctly, I think there were 26 witches hanged in America. We hang our witches rather than burn them like they do in the savage states of Europe or whatever. And I think
we're
five
civilized.
Of them were men, actually. So
well, didn't they? Some of them were pressed
to death, too.
Oh, there
was at least one got crushed.
Giles Corey. Yeah,
Giles Corey got crushed.
That's
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, the idea of, I think most of them seem to have been young women. They did have those meetings out in the woods sometimes with, what's her name? Hecuba or the
Tituba.
Haitian girl.
Tituba.
Yeah. And so like if you're the kind of like, you know, fledgling hierarchy of the like kind of Puritan church, the old men basically, like that's what's going on out there. You know, this is where like the setting, you know, the idea of like the woods even as being the place of the devil, because they're they're wild. They're, you know, they haven't been civilized yet. We haven't, you know, tamed that. The Indians are out there. The Native Americans are out there. You know, that's like, that's all, I think, playing into this.
It's like paranoia.
It's almost time for my periodic screening of the great film, The Witch.
I love that movie.
Yeah. Can I read a little bit? Can I read a little bit?
We'll bring it in. Yeah.
One other thing about Cotton Mather is he became sort of a witch hunter. Not in any Netflix style, carrying a sword around, but he was at the Salem witch trials. I think he spoke in court.
Brad, you've got to lean into this stuff. You want a publishing career? You want a Netflix special, dude? Cotton Mather,
Witch Hunter.
That's a young adult literature. I'd watch that.
I'd watch the shit out of that,
yeah,
Brad.
Yeah. So let me read this little bit from an interesting book. I haven't read the whole thing, but I read a few chapters of it today, called The Devil's Dominion, Magic and Religion in Early New England by a guy named Richard Godbeer. All right, I'm just going to read this one paragraph. It includes Cotton Mather and a witch investigation he did. So a little bit of preamble first, though. Magic enabled New Englanders to change their world as well as to see it more clearly. Transformative magic was a double-edged weapon. People used it both to heal the sick and to hurt their enemies. This kind of magic operated by treating chosen objects as the images of other objects or people. Such images were not merely symbolic. Each participated in the substantive reality of what is represented, so that changes wrought in an image could be reproduced in its counterpart. We think of that as voodoo. We think of this as basically voodoo dolls. Like, most people have no consciousness that this was a practice in America in, you know, the 1600s. Thus, when an individual stuck pins or thorns in the representation of an enemy, the image served as much more than a symbol. It was an actual extension of a person. Harm inflicted upon the image would also be undergone by the enemy. Charms operated in a similar way to image magic. Specific formulas and ceremonies could produce physical change in an object or a person. A spell or ritual was taken to represent a given effect, so that its performance brought about the effect. Just as an effigy was mutilated to harm the individual represented, so the recitation of a spell brought about the effect that it was understood to symbolize. Again, we've got that language is magic, is witchcraft thing. Okay. Through the use of image magic, people could reach and transform anything or anyone. Goodwife Glover, a Catholic Irish woman who lived in Boston, who used image magic to attack her enemies, was brought to trial in 1688 for afflicting the children of her neighbor, John Goodwin. According to Cotton Mather's account, quote, order was given to search the old woman's house, from whence there were brought into court several small images or puppets or babies made of rags and stuffed with goat's hair and other such ingredients. So according to this, she was doing, like, it wasn't an innocent accusation, right?
Yeah, but nobody ever asks the question, what did they do to deserve it?
Nobody ever asked, right,
clearly.
Glover, quote, acknowledged that her way to torment the objects of her malice was by wetting her finger with her spittle and stroking of those little images. Mather knew another unnamed woman, quote, whose brother was tortured with a cruel, prickling, incurable pain in the crown of his head, which continued until there was found with her a poppet in wax resembling him, with a pin stuck into the head of it, which being taken out, he recovered immediately. At the Salem witch trials in 1692, a remarkable number of testimonies mentioned the use of poppets to inflict harm. A few examples. I do it. This is a confession, basically. I do it by rolling up a handkerchief and so imagining to be a representation of a person. The way of her afflicting, and this is another one, another testimony about another somebody who's a witch, supposedly. The way of her afflicting was by sticking pins into things and clothes and thinking of hurting them. Right. So this is apparently.
Yo, that is so metal. That would be the way of her afflicting. That is a metal band name, dude. The way of her afflicting. Yeah.
So let me just read this last little bit. Whether or not these particular claims are true, that these are poppets are being used as what we would think of now as voodoo dolls. The people of Essex County were clearly familiar with the principle and practice of image magic. As in the case of Goodwife Glover, there was physical as well as anecdotal evidence for the existence and use of poppets by the accused. Two of Bridget Bishop's neighbors, that's a girl who was involved in the Salem witch trials, two of her neighbors had found several poppets in her cellar while knocking down a wall for her. the poppets had pins stuck in them. Another of the accused, Elizabeth Johnson, actually produced three poppets in court. So I just thought it was interesting because my take, to be honest, my take had been that mostly the witch accusations had been not about. And again, I'm not saying these women should have been hanged because they had poppets that they were sticking pins in. But I had always thought it was just like trumped up charges that, like, you know,
what you're telling me, what I'm hearing here, Brad, is that witchcraft is real.
Yeah.
Maybe there was something going on. Maybe there was something to it. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
And of course, there's like it's biblical, like thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, you know. So like that's important to them at the time. I just want to also, what the other side of like the, you know, the kind of converse side of this is that within 10, really interesting historical fact, like within 10 years of these witch trials, you can read like criticism of what happened that's just as scathing as what we'd expect to find now. So it's like, it's like they very quickly kind of separated themselves from it. And you get, and so like Ben Franklin's born in 1703. It's like, there's this immediate cooling of religious fervor to kind of rectify this insanity, which makes a lot of sense, you know?
Yeah. It's like,
and again, you get the Jonathan Edwards thing. And so this seems to be part of what America does, is this like fervor of religious kind of faith. And then it collapses because something went wrong. You know?
Well, and we see that. I mean, like, we had the satanic panic in our lifetimes, right?
What I was going to bring up is when you talked about like the witch being the, you know, the hot topic girl. I mean, I think that's like actually a little dated. Like right now, the witch is the, you know, it's the guys who are hiding behind avatars on Twitter. That's why they're hiding. They know they'll get in trouble if they kind of just say these things in public, you know? So like the witch is always kind of the one who's on the margin and who is in the woods, you know, in the untamed parts. And I think like that's kind of, that's like one of these almost perennial things. And what, you know, whether like whether you identify with the witches or the men who hanged them, like sort of depends on, you know, like what part of your mind you want to emphasize on a given day, something like that, you know.
Cotton Mather, Witch Hunter, coming to Netflix.
Yeah.
2028.
Vin Diesel.
Right. Starring Vin Diesel and Brad Kelly. Brad Kelly as
like, I'm
the
sure
first, the first witch that Cotton Mather hunts.
What's the Arthur Miller play called about the witches?
The Crucible.
The Crucible. The Crucible is like, in the Crucible's version of it, it's like obviously it's that's
metaphor
like
for the communists,
anti-communist stuff or whatever, and like it's American paranoia, and there's no such thing as witches, and we should all just love each other. Like that's kind of what the Miller play is kind of hinting at. But just as easily retell the play where it's like actually very important to take care of the witch problem, or else, like, you know, the fascists are going to win.
All hell is going to break loose in some way. Yeah. Or it could be that, the thing that this makes me think is like, sometimes you might actually need the witches.
Yeah,
right?
That's the other part of it. Yeah.
Right.
That might actually be an important reservoir of, you know,
hang on here. I'm just, as we close down here, I'm just taking a final note for the Patreon. The gang solves the WQ, the witch question.
Okay.